descriptions, and the titles are clearly titles of great power and divinity. In Greek, they're megas, soter, great, powerful, savior. Some of the titles look very much like the titles of the great Iranian kings, the Persian kings, King of Kings. Others clearly show indications of familiarity with the cults of Shiva, the great god of the Hindus. And all of this is being proclaimed by rulers who are wearing traditional steppe nomadic costumes. That is, the leather breeches, they sometimes carry the felt caps of the steppes, and they clearly represent a group of nomadic conquerors who have been exposed to Chinese civilization. They're projecting themselves essentially as a nomadic version of the Son of Heaven, the Chinese emperor. They picked up notions from the Hellenistic world. They've come into contact with early Iranian cults as well as cults of Hinduism. On the reverse, we see the same group of images, and this is seen in the divinities that the emperors choose to venerate on their coins. It is a wide array of gods. None of these emperors, even Kanishka, who is very, very well remembered in the Buddhist tradition, was a strict Buddhist and simply followed Dharma, the way, and nothing else. There's a wonderful coin, particularly of the last of those five rulers, Huvishka. He ruled in the middle to late 2nd century AD. The dates are not really that well known, but he's shown mounted on an elephant in full regalia like a Hindu prince. And the iconography suggests he was making a royal progress, the Digvijaya in later Hindu tradition, in which he moves among the four quarters of the world, summoning his vassals in a great show of pageantry. In addition, there is quite an array of gods. One of the most frequent ones found on the coins is Osho, an old Iranian god. He's clearly shown with the attributes of the Greek god Heracles, Hercules to the Romans, but also he's almost a dead ringer for Shiva. He's shown with four arms. He has the bull as his vehicle. That would be Nandi in the Hindu tradition. The Bactrian goddess, I mentioned Nana, she's worshipped in the inscription. She appears virtually as a Greek goddess Tyche, the goddess of good fortune. There are some coins that suggest that there are seated figures who may be the Buddha. Clearly, there are an array of gods well known from Persian texts, such as Mithra, gods such as Hermes and Heracles from the Greek tradition. It is a medley of divinities in the Kushan pantheon. And this, too, is a feature of the steppe nomads. I mentioned it in passing, but it'll be particularly relevant to the Mongol period. Nomadic conquerors were very, very pragmatic about the gods. Any holy man, any mystic, any individual who had contact with the other powers, well, it was worth listening to him or her. These could be sorceresses. These could be the equivalent of Greek Pythias. They were shamans on the steppes. And that meant all of the gods were venerated. All of the gods were seen as a contact to the divine. And nomadic conquerors were unusually tolerant of the different faiths within their multinational empires. And so you don't get on the iconography of the coins nearly the same kind of strict iconography you will get from their successors. That is, the two states that partition this Kushan Empire in the 4th century, and that is the resurgent Iranian Empire under the Sassanid Shahs, who are strict Zoroastrians, and that's all you get on their iconography, or in India, the great Gupta emperors, who essentially are mounting a comeback for the Hindu cults. The coins and the inscription together also now allow us to draw a map and really get some sense of the boundaries that these five emperors ruled over. And starting with the first emperor, Kuchula Kadphises, the Kushans came over the Hindu Kush and began to conquer the Indus Valley. And that was not finished until probably the end of the 1st century AD. By the time of Kanishka's reign, in the early 2nd century AD, the Kushan Empire extended from the Jaxartes, even beyond on the steppes, on the cities of the Tarim Basin, across Transoxiana, Afghanistan, the Indus Valley, most of the Ganges, and this emperor ruled over a vast territory, including the areas that were the cradle of Buddhism, the very, very important cities on the middle Ganges, where many of the important Buddhist sites were located, particularly Sarnath, where the Buddha himself had had his enlightenment. And this has been quite a revelation. It's been gained by the distribution of coins, that is, where are they found, as well as the information from the inscription that names very, very specific Indian cities that are under the control of the Kushan Emperor. Well, that gets us perhaps to the most important aspect about this empire, and that is whatever these Kushan emperors were like, and we really don't have the literary sources that make these men come to life. We've got wonderful portraits of them. We can surmise how they projected themselves. We have this marvelous inscription that is an insight into their religious beliefs. But who they are as personalities and individuals, such as Attila the Hun or later Genghis Khan, the information isn't there. But there are two important activities that these kings clearly carried out. And it is also now clear that Kanishka, who was very fondly remembered in the Buddhist texts, was even credited with summoning a Buddhist council to try to work out the issues of dogma, that these emperors built a state which is now recognized as on par with the early Mauryan Empire, the Empire of Ashoka, which is regarded as the first empire of India, and then the successor state known as the Gupta. The Kushan Empire was an Indian empire plus parts of Central Asian steppes and Transoxiana. And in some ways, it also anticipates the great empire of the Mughals, which will come much later in the course, the final summation of the Mughal, of the Muslim imperial tradition in India. And this is a revelation to us. Much of what we knew about the Kushans had been very, very speculative up until the 1990s. And reconstructing the success of this nomadic empire is really a triumph of archaeology, numismatics, philology, all of those specialized fields, and culling information from a wide variety of literary sources. Well, two points are clear. The Kushan emperors, given their origin, promoted what becomes the Silk Road, especially that spur that leads into India. They are behind the development of the Silk Road that becomes the first great international trade system. We'll be talking about that in a separate lecture, but they control really the middle portion of those routes that link the Middle East and Rome with China. In so doing, they encourage the development of cities, and it's in those cities where Buddhist monks began to translate the scriptures from Sanskrit into the vernacular languages, and enabled the dissemination of Buddhism across the Silk Road, where it would become the second great cultural influence on the steppes, the first, of course, being China. In addition to that, the Kushan emperors embraced all of those Greek arts. They ruled in the city of Taxila, which was a Greek-style city. They clearly had winter residences in Bactra, that is, former cities of the Greco-Bactrian kings. And they sponsored a great deal of marvelous art, the art of Gandhara, very well known to art historians in northern India. It's a composite of Indian traditions and Greek traditions. It brings in Greek naturalism with Indian traditions of sculpture and produces the first great images of the Buddha. And this is occurring under the auspices of the Kushan emperors. How much they're involved in it, we don't know. But clearly, this work is going on in the very capitals and winter palaces and cities of the Kushan state. The Kushans clearly favored Buddhism. They may not have embraced it, but they were very great patrons. This has been borne out not only by the evidence of some of the coins, which may sometimes be interpreted as having Buddhist symbolism, but particularly at the great monastery complex at Sanchi. And Sanchi is perhaps one of the most early Buddhist sites in India. It's a great monastery going back to Ashoka's day. There's a stupa, and the stupa is much earlier. But in the first century AD, in the period of the Kushan emperors, there are these great gates, Toranas, that are built. And on those gates are marvelous relief work of the incidents of the life of the Buddha. And for the first time, the Buddha is now depicted in human form. This is an influence from the Greek artistic traditions merging with the Indian, creating a new iconography for Buddhism of the greater vehicle, that is, the Buddhism destined to win the loyalties of so many peoples in Transoxiana and Central Asia. And significantly, there is an inscription from Sanchi that praises Kanishka for his donations. So the connections are real. They are not imagined. The Kushan emperors really stood behind Buddhism as one of the great faces of their empire, and that's why Kanishka was regarded so fondly by later Buddhist writers. And in that, perhaps, is the greatest tradition of the Kushan legacy, Buddhism. Under their auspices, Buddhism transformed itself into a universal religion, and in the process won East Asia. But ironically, at the same time, they start losing their homeland, India. For the Kushan Empire in India fell to the Gupta emperors in the 4th century. And the Gupta emperors not only ended Kushan rule, but they also mounted a recovery of Hinduism.
Lecture 8. Rome and the Sarmatians.
In this lecture, I want to deal with a group of people known as the Sarmatians. They are Iranian speakers, remote kinsmen to the Parthians and the Sakai. However, they're operating on the steppes immediately to the west, and they come to dominate the Pontic-Caspian steppes, which was the original homeland of the Indo-European speakers. The Sarmatians appear in classical sources starting end of the 3rd, beginning of the 2nd century BC. And so they are contemporaries with the Sakai, those Tokharians who eventually become the Kushan emperors, and the Parthians. But as I noted, they were originally dwelling in the lands to the east of the Ural Mountains, that is, the steppes north of the Caspian and Aral Sea. And they seem to have connections with tribes that had some kind of contact with the Chinese Empire. When we discuss several of the tribes that are known from classical sources, notably the Alans, it'll be evident that there's some kind of connection with China. We're not sure whether these tribes in remote times were members of the Xuannu Confederacy, whether they had ancestors that once bordered on the western and northwestern frontiers of China, but there's been a lot of learned scholarship to try to connect the two. More significantly and immediately, they had moved into this homeland probably due to local circumstances, the need for pastures, severe droughts, clashes and blood feuds with neighboring tribes had brought the Sarmatians to occupy this very important corridor stretching from essentially the northern shores of the Caspian over to the Aral Sea and the upper Jaxartes. And that area is an important corridor that will link the western steppes to the central steppes and eastern steppes. And the Sarmatians are on that nexus of routes in, say, 300 BC. From there, they decide to migrate west. Exactly why, we're not sure. We have no real written records on this. Some have tried to connect them with the Sarmatai. Those are a tribe that are known to be vassals in the 5th century BC to the Scythians. They're mentioned in Herodotus. But whatever happened, somewhere around 300 BC, the Sarmatians begin to move west and eventually cross the Volga and enter into that Pontic-Caspian steppe zone, that region that stretches from the Dniester River to the Volga. Today, we actually call that the South Russian steppes. On the southern borders of it is the Black Sea. To the north stretch the great forest zones of Russia, which then lead to the Baltic. And as I noted, these Sarmatians move into not only an ideal area for their stock raising, but also the great river systems of the Volga, the Don, the Dnieper, the Dniester, the Bug, all of these great river systems that flow from north to south across the steppes and link the Caspian and Black Sea by trade routes to the Baltic. So the Sarmatians, just as their predecessors, the Scythians, come to control that important trade that goes from the Baltic to the Black Sea or to the Caspian Sea if it's coming down the Volga River. And they, too, exploited the transit of this trade by taxing and levying customs on it, by providing protection, by offering a market themselves, setting up market towns and settlements. And therefore, all the products of the forest, the great amber prized in classical sources, the goods from the Arctic would have to come through essentially Sarmatian domains and would head to the Greek ports on the Black Sea, particularly on the cities of the Crimea, which the Greeks called the Tauric Chersonesus. And those Greek cities will flourish through the Roman Empire, really into the early Byzantine age. Another important aspect about the Sarmatians is they're prized as soldiers, especially as mercenaries, even more so than the Scythians. And we have a number of reports of Sarmatian mercenaries being hired in Hellenistic and even Roman armies. In the great clash between Mithridates VI of Pontus, who ruled in Eastern Asia Minor, and the proconsul Lucius Licinius Lucullus, both sides recruited Sarmatian cataphracti. These are heavily armored cavalrymen, quite distinct from the horse archers, which we'll get into in a moment why the Sarmatians are able to do this. And so the Sarmatians become a military force. And as a result of mercenary service, many Sarmatians go into Greek towns. They serve in the wider Hellenistic world. They intermarry with Greek or Greek-speaking populations, and they bring back a taste of goods from the Mediterranean world. This taste, of course, fuels the trade. Another item that's big, and something that the Scythians undoubtedly engaged in, but we have a lot of evidence from the Roman period, is in the slave trade. And slaves are excess population sold on the ports of the Greek cities, and this will become a tradition of henceforth on these steps of selling slaves, labor, and in the Muslim world, soldiers, off the Pontic Caspian steppes into the wider Middle East and Mediterranean world. And that is another important feature of the trade developed by these Sarmatians. Well, the Sarmatians, after 100 BC, begin to move out of that Caspian Pontic steppe region, or the Pontic Caspian steppes, as I've been calling them. And we know them from several different tribes. These are offshoots of the Sarmatians, and they're recognized as independent groups in Greek and Roman sources. One of them is the Jazages, or Jazages. That Latin I is pronounced as a J. That initial I is really a consonant in Latin. And the other are the Roxolani. A third group are the Alans. Discuss them in a moment. The first two groups, they move westward and southwestward. Now, this is a natural route to follow. We will see that a number of steppe nomadic peoples in the Middle Ages will follow those routes. They leave the South Russian steppes. They move into the region today known as the Dobruja, which is the delta of the Danube, a heavy marsh area that's very, very attractive for nomads to herd their animals during the winter. Also, the regions today that are eastern Hungary, especially the traditional region of Wallachia, very good grasslands there. Another zone they move into are the Hungarian plains, or as the Romans would call it, the Pannonian plains. And so the Sarmatians are essentially attracted to find new grasslands, new areas to exploit, and they're undoubtedly subjecting and assimilating the pre-existing populations there. Now, these two new tribes, the Roxolani and the Jazages, come into contact with Central European cultures. These include the Dacians. The Dacians dominate most of what is today Romania and the Carpathian Mountains. They are a Thraco-Illyrian-speaking people. They are Indo-European speakers. Their language goes back to PIE, Proto-Indo-European. It broke off very early. And linguistically today, they would be remotely related to Albanians, actually. They also come into contact with Celts and eventually with Germanic peoples. As a result of this contact, there is a great deal of trade, intermarriage, and exchange. And the Sarmatians gain an enormous amount of metal technology. The Sarmatian aristocracy amasses great wealth. They don't seem to put it into great tombs, kurgans, as the Scythians did. What they seem to do is spend that wealth in other ways, foremost in acquiring good horses and arms. It is clear from depictions And here the Romans help us a great deal. The Romans, being such a visual people, like to put up reliefs of all sorts of individuals, especially conquered individuals. And we have a number of depictions of Sarmatian cavalry, and it is clear they are getting horses off the steppes, probably breeds related to the heavenly horses that sweat blood, the so-called Ferragana horses. Another aspect about these reliefs is they show that the Sarmatians are unusually well armed. We can get a sense of the military potential of their Sarmatians because of these later Roman reliefs and Roman sources. By the time of the Emperor Trajan, from 98 to 117 AD, the whole of the Rhine, Danube, and the Dacian areas have long been Roman provinces, and the Romans have set up secure frontiers along the Rhine and Danube. And the Sarmatian tribes that border on the upper and lower and middle Danube provinces have been in long contact with Romans and the Germanic peoples of Central Europe. And because of their trade connections, they've gained a great deal of wealth, and this undoubtedly was put into better armament. The reliefs show that the Sarmatians still depend very much on the mounted horse archer. And there's every reason to believe, especially when we deal with Roman tactical manuals, that the Sarmatians are 90% light cavalry. But a significant 10% are heavy cavalry, and that means men who are armed in this heavy lamellar armor that is an overlapping set of scales, and they are called in Greek and Roman sources cataphracti. That term becomes a generalized term in the Roman age and then into the Byzantine and early medieval age for heavy cavalry lancers. The Parthians, too, apparently had such cavalry, but we have unusually few depictions of it from the Parthian army. We're really depending on depictions of Sarmatians as they've come down through the Romans. Furthermore, they're armed with a very distinct conical helmet, a helmet that will go on to live very much a version of this helmet. It's a more elaborate version that gets to be the common helmet worn by Turkic tribes and later Mongol tribes of the Middle Ages. And so steppe cavalry armies now are differentiated. They're not just horse archers. They surely now start with a attack by horse archers, but invariably these armies carry well-mounted cataphracts, lancers, men who can enter into a melee and destroy the enemy close up. And this is a combination that the Romans are very, very well aware of in dealing with the Sarmatians on their northern frontier. So in any, say, any kind of Sarmatian cavalry force, such as Alans operating out of the Caucasus or Roxolani on the Danube, out of a 10,000 cavalry, you could expect to encounter some 1 to 2,000 heavily armed cataphracti, and the Romans themselves, starting in the 2nd century AD, mount such cavalry and repeatedly hire Sarmatians as Roman auxiliary units. I think Marcus Aurelius actually hires some 7,000 of them. 6,500 of them are sent to Britain as auxiliary forces, and that gives rise to that rather strange movie that was released on King Arthur several years ago, where they're turned into Sarmatians serving in Britain, which is something of a strange fantasy. But nonetheless, it is based in the fact that the Romans come to appreciate both the light cavalry and the heavy cavalry and are incorporating them into their own army. As another point I would like to make, and again to stress some of the improvements in military technology, which were probably available to all the steppe peoples at this point, besides the heavy cavalry, besides the horse archers, it is clear that they have an effective system of command, regimental commands. We suspect this in the army of the Shuang Nu, just by the titles of the kings, but the Romans tell us Sarmatians go into battle in military units. These battles are designated by distinct banners. Among them, the inflated leather dragons. Draconis would be the Roman term for it, the Latin. And these dragons are, again, ultimately of Chinese origin. There really are no dragons in Greek and Roman mythology. They're great serpents. And dragons in Chinese society, in Chinese tradition, of course, are creatures associated with the spirit of mountains. They're actually beneficial creatures. They are picked up by nomadic peoples as symbols and emblems for the different tribal regiments. They are brought into battle to spur on the troops. The Romans notice them and adopt them. And it's probably through the Sarmatians that the classic medieval dragon, to be slain by the heavily armored medieval knight, passes into the European consciousness. And this is a steppe nomadic mediation of a Chinese notion that eventually gets into Western European traditions. We have an unusually good tactical manual by a man named Arrian, dealing with a group of Sarmatians who have attacked into Roman Asia Minor or Anatolia. And his name is actually Lucius Laevius Arrianus Xenophon. He is a Greek speaker from Asia Minor. He actually comes from, I believe, the city of Nicomedia, today Izmit, in Turkey. And he served as a Roman senator, and he was a governor of the province of Cappadocia, Galatia Cappadocia in Asia Minor. In 135 AD, he had to deal with a group of this Sarmatian cavalry. And he wrote a tactical manual, which is known as the Tactical Battle Array Against the Alans. Some have regarded it as a theoretical military manual, but it isn't. What it is a very, very detailed analysis of how he set up a battle line to counter an attack of nomadic cavalry that had passed through the Dariel Pass in the Caucasus and had entered into Asia Minor. That manual, which has come down to us from the Middle Ages, is one of our earliest accounts of how to deal with a threat like this. And it probably, with proper changes, could be applied to the Chinese armies of the Han Dynasty, as well as to later medieval armies, to probably Sassanid armies dealing with later nomadic powers. Arrian commanded a force of about 11,500 legionaries and assorted auxiliary units. He had with him some 5,000 cavalry. This is unusual proportion for a Roman army. Roman armies usually have a proportion of 1-7, cavalry to infantry. This is a 1-2. 1-2, 1-3 becomes the common proportion in dealing with steppe nomads. Arrian records a very detailed order of march. He explains how you draw up the battle line with the legionaries in the center, occupying a gently sloping hill, the upper level of it. The legionaries are to be supported with wings that are advanced of auxiliary infantry with lots of archers. Even the legionary line is modified, where they are to stand in close ranks, presenting a unbroken front of pila. That's the Roman throwing spear, but instead they're using it as a phalanx rather than casting it at the foe. And the back two lines, the ninth and tenth ranks, are archers, infantry and horse archers, shooting over the infantry as a barrage. The Roman cavalry is held in reserve behind. And the idea is to receive the attack of the nomadic cavalry of horse archers, which is to break up the Roman infantry formation so that that heavy cavalry can ride in and get it, but to draw that cavalry close to punish it with firepower of infantry archers. And then when they come too close, for that Roman cavalry to charge out and encircle and destroy. That type of tactic requires remarkable discipline. It would require fighting for hours to get the Alans or any nomadic cavalry to commit themselves to such a close order battle, and then it requires perfect timing to launch your cavalry attacks to encircle it. If you